Jason Halsey and the Liminalist, the podcast between. Talking to Darren Westland, also known as Derek Swanson, also known as Crash Gordon. There's a bit of an audio buzz on Darren's end of the conversation for about the first 10 minutes, but after that it's fine, so just bear with it until then.
Thinking we should maybe start with our use of pseudonyms, since that will be kind of a good leading for people that don't really know me at all, and of course they know you've been doing it with your names, but
anyway. Before we get to that, I wanted you to refresh my memory in terms of how we did hook up. Because I think you mentioned that I'd reached out to you, and I've got this vague memory of finding something out about you on Rigorous Intuition and then tracking you down. Is that right?
Yes, that's how I remember it, at least. I think I was writing about Carl Jung and hypnopompic and hypnagogic hallucinations, and I had mentioned your book, I think, at some point.
That's right.
Because you were slipping in on the conversation, and I had told you that I'd read your book long before I actually published my first book, Crash Gordon and the Mysteries of Kingsburg. So that's where it started, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, that rings a bell now. The Jung and the Lucid View and the Crash Gordon.
Right. So that's where it started, and I don't know, Rigorous Intuition, I think, was the gathering place for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's got a lot to account for, that place. So then, the first thing that you read of mine was under the Aeolus Cephas pseudonym then.
That's right, yeah. So, and, it's when you sent me that article about Fernando Pessoa, I thought it definitely applied to both of us. I mean, with his use of fictional alter egos. And, I'd never heard the term heteronyms before, which is what he was calling it.
What's the difference between a heteronym and a pseudonym, then?
I don't know. In the article, they defined it as, quote, fully fledged characters endowed with their own biographies, philosophies, and literary styles. Went on to say, Pessoa even imagined encounters among them and allowed them to comment on one another's work, which is something that I've done, in a sense, with my characters, the Derek Swanson character, who started out as just a peripheral brother character in the first novel, and by the last novel, Crash Gordon and the Illuminati Underground, he was basically the main character, and of course he's always been a pseudonym. And then I had Crash Gordon actually write and publish a book called Nitwit Ridge, which exists as a standalone book. So, it's not exactly sure why I did that myself, but what about you? What was your need to go by Aeolus Cephas and Jake the screenwriter and all those names?
Well, the thing about pseudonyms now, the context I see it in now, it's not going to surprise you, is that I discovered more recently, at least something that my wife said, I'm not sure I've actually done much research or found the documentation on it, but that it's quite symptomatic of people who've suffered extreme trauma, is that they...
I am not surprised by that. I've never read that anywhere, but it doesn't surprise me at all.
No, I mean, it makes sense right away, doesn't it? Who's had a hard time getting into their skin due to interference and whatnot is going to want to be constantly trying on different identities to see which ones fit, which is something that most of us go through in adolescence or before and after, just that very process of like, who am I and how can I create an external sort of identity that's going to A, more or less fit with my sense of who I am, and B, that the world will acknowledge and recognize and appreciate that whole thing
Right.
that I talk about in Seen and Not Seen. So then the picking different names is a literalization of that.
Yes.
Even that tradition, right, in Judaism, that when you name something, you give it the qualities associated with that name or that word. So then with the Aeolus, I mean, that was just a very literal enactment of the occult tradition of, you know, giving yourself a magical name. But it was ostensibly, it was motivated by pragmatism, you know, at a conscious level. I suppose we always have a conscious version that seems perfectly rational, don't we?
Some great rationalization to do whatever it is we were going to do anyway.
And so I had written Matrix Warrior, published Matrix Warrior, and initially Lucid View was going to, I'd already written it long before Matrix Warrior, but I thought, oh, I'll make it the follow-up to Matrix Warrior because I'm going to be a big hit with that one. So then this is going to be the follow-up, and I talk about lucids in Matrix Warrior. So then it's going to be a continuation of that idea of the lucid. And but then I changed my mind. I think it was my partner at the time. I think she gently persuaded me to be more cautious in terms of the stuff I was writing about in Lucid View post 9/11. So then, so then anyway, that was the practical reason for it. The pragmatic reason was just, okay, I'll keep these identities separate.
Right. I had something similar going on. I wasn't thinking of it in terms of the occult at all, but when I became the creative director of a newspaper and realized that I was going to start publishing a lot of articles and photos, I took a different last name, an older family name on my grandmother's side, just because it was more distinctive than the name I'd been born with. And that kind of stuck with me and kind of solidified with my reputation as a journalist. I had some local fame, writing and, you know, doing my thing there. It was actually kind of a nice local level of celebrity, which I've never really found since, but I kind of enjoyed it. And so when I started publishing my novels, I just had that in mind, and I thought, well, you know, I already have this reputation as a photographer with Darren Westland. Why don't I take another name for the novels and keep those two careers separate?
Right.
And so I did that. And also I was thinking that I could kind of protect the people who knew me, because there was, again, you know, some people were saying, well, you shouldn't really be writing this, and, you know, you're talking about the CIA, you're talking about family history, all this stuff. So I thought using a pseudonym could give me a little give the people in my life a little distance, you know, and muddle the connection between them and me. But, of course, that didn't end up working out. Anybody that wanted to find out who really wrote my books was able to very quickly. And soon enough, my first book was being discussed, probably with disapproval, at the Kingsburg United Baptist Church Book Club. So it got around rather quickly.
Is that book club one that is close to your family history then? Is that why you mentioned
It's the town I grew up in. So the first book was called Crash Gordon and the Mysteries of Kingsburg. And, you know, there aren't many Kingsburgs in the world. So very quickly it got around that little town, which is about 5,000 or 6,000 people.
And what was your exposure to that fact? Like, how did you find out that it was causing consternation?
People that were still living there at the time that were in touch with me wrote to me and told me. So they thought it was hilarious. You know, some of my old high school friends have been in on it from the start, and that's probably how the word got around in the first place.
And so, how did you feel about it?
I was okay with it. My father didn't speak to me for a couple of years, but we got past that. So.
Wow, so that's a result. Right there.
I guess that wasn't intended, but, you know, sometimes describing things that happen to you in your own life has a spillover effect, and other people, of course, were kind of sharing that life with you, and yeah, things happen. So
it's kind of a classic syndrome with writers. That, I mean, I read about it all the time and hear about it. Writers who end up upsetting people in their lives, even when they just represent them fictionally, that people recognize that they're being represented, and
yeah,
and that general feeling you can't trust a writer because he'll turn anything into fodder for his work. And certainly I've experienced it from the other side, reading my brother's memoir,
of course,
quasi fictional memoir, but I haven't experienced it as a writer. I wouldn't say that. Maybe I'm just oblivious. It's quite possible I'm just so oblivious that I haven't really noticed if people have been disturbed or ruffled by what I'm doing.
Well, you would think they'd let you know. Sebastian never talked to you about your writing?
Occasionally, but certainly I never wrote about him until after he was dead, or at least Paper Tiger was, I published that. It was in the mail, literally, when he died. So,
right. I know your podcast, some of them were before he died.
Yeah,
certainly. And you were talking about him there.
Yes, that's right. I don't know to this day if he was aware of them. I think he probably was, because I think that people in his circle were aware of them before then, before he died. But that's only speculation. But in terms of the books I wrote prior to Paper Tiger, there's nothing autobiographical in there.
So yeah, I don't remember anything in Lucid View that was autobiographical at all. In fact, I couldn't figure out who you were at all. I remember thinking, the guy that wrote this is probably some, ayahuasca drinking, shaman that probably likes to go to rave parties somewhere. And as it turned out, that was kind of half true.
It wasn't a million miles away, not the rave. Well, I guess I spent a brief period going to raves even. Yeah. So, yeah. And that was definitely part of the Aeolus Cephas goal.
Mystique.
Just create mystique, exactly.
Yeah.
Which I'm kind of against now, kind of opposed
yeah,
to.
Yeah, I got that sense. I really did like that article you wrote that was, what was that, on Reality Sandwich, about your drug experiences and how you kind of regretted them at this point.
The one about psychedelics in general and the effects they
yeah.
have.
Yeah, right, yeah. So, but I wanted to ask you, I mean, I've heard a lot of people talk about their DMT experiences, and it always seems like, it has the vagueness of a dream, that they come back and they say, well, I can't really tell you about it. It was fantastic. And, the things I'll describe, though, won't make sense. And they faded very quickly. I mean, did you have anything that was like life changing out of all those experiences, all those trips you took?
Because now I have to stay on the fence about it now, because I'm kind of damned if I do and damned if I don't. What's the safest answer? Because it's not like me to play safe. But I mean, I absolutely believe that I had a life-changing experience on DMT. I refer to it as my red pill experience in the Matrix Warrior bio. I even put the date, October 27th, 2000. It was the experience that I had with my friend Mitch, and he wrote a song about it called What It's Like to Die, and that was my experience of it. I thought, this is what it's like to die, now I know, at least potentially. Well, actually, it was terrifying as well as liberating, so not necessarily potentially, perhaps inevitably, but a combination of both, the terror and then the epiphany of death. I was completely convinced, obviously at the time, but afterwards as well, that I had experienced something absolutely real, an event in the future in a certain sense. And it was after it was that night that I had a vision of my brother dying. I say vision, I had a dream that I interpreted as a vision that my brother killed himself. and then I went back to England as a result of that. So I mean that is literally life changing in the sense that I it changed my actions and in a major way. And then in retrospect, it was that dream, you know, was correct. I did see something that was coming, although the elements of the dream weren't accurate. I dreamt that he shot himself in the head.
Yeah, not the way it happened. Okay.
So, in that regard, obviously it had a massive impact. But then of course, one could say that, you know, many things are life changing. It doesn't necessarily mean in a positive sense. Things change your behavior. So obviously doing the psychedelics changed my behavior. I mean, I wouldn't have been doing them if they weren't going to change something. You know, that was the whole point. I was seeking out change. The on the fence, why I'm on the fence now is that it's almost impossible for me to separate the inspiration and the insight that I got from the ego inflation.
Yeah. Well, what I'm wondering is, I mean, how different is it from a really big lucid dream? I mean, if you had a dream like that where the same things happened, would you have acted on it? Or was it only because you were taking DMT that you thought, wow, I've got to go back to England and save my brother?
No, it wasn't. No, I mean, I would say I wouldn't have had the dream without the DMT, but that's just speculative. And because it happened right after, there's a cause and effect, you know, causality appears to be in play. But right. No, I've had plenty of lucid dreams that when obviously the result of doing psychedelics that I've, if not acted on, certainly incorporated into my daily belief system as if they were real.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, when you say you died, is it more of an ego death, or did you actually experience physical death somehow in that state?
Well, I did mean that this is what it's like to physically die. That's what I believe, but I didn't physically die, and I physically left my body in the sense that I was completely disconnected from physical reality. I had no point of reference. I mean, my memory of that DMT trip, you know, what I can remember of it is of being in a completely abstract or dissociated realm in which my body didn't exist. So, but obviously it did exist because I didn't die. And when I came back, Mitch told me that I'd been screaming my lungs out, and you know, there had been physical activity occurring. Yeah. I had just not been there for it.
You weren't there to see it. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. I've had similar experiences with Robert Monroe type out of body traveling. You know, where I can actually, you know, look down from the ceiling and see my own body in bed, you know, and think, wow, well, I'm out of it.
Have you been able to corroborate that what you were seeing was physically accurate in those experiences?
I would only have myself as a witness. You know, I was sleeping alone when I did it. So, yeah, I scared the crap out of me, though. I didn't know how I'd get back in. And then, of course, as soon as I got scared, I was yanked back in.
Yeah.
But, and then I, you know, experimented with it more later.
Yeah.
But, that's one of those experiences that convinced me that something probably continues to exist after our bodies fall by the wayside.
Yeah.
You know? Can't be sure, of course, but it seems more likely to me now, definitely.
Yeah.
I've got a new one. You've got one too, and with our new one, we'll make the gray skies blue. And if we run out, we'll simply run out to the store and get some more. And you've got one too. And
So, have you ever experimented with that? Have you tried the Monroe tapes or done anything that?
I haven't. I mean, I've read Monroe's books, and of course now I have lots of paranoid theories about him.
of course.
But leaving that aside,
yeah,
his military connections and whatnot, I was definitely impressed by the books. But I don't think they influenced me particularly in my experiments in astral projection. I think that was something that was going to happen anyway.
Right.
And maybe even was happening before I read him. I'm not sure. I think I did read him quite early on. Maybe it was influenced. You know, maybe I'm going to have to do a expose of Monroe next.
But maybe.
Yeah, it's not. But it wasn't an obvious influence.
Okay. There was one little trick that he taught me that was what ended up working, because you know, I've been a lucid dreamer my entire life, but I had never really gotten completely out of the body in that sense, that kind of physical sense, until I read something where he said you have to try stretching for something like, say, across the room or out the window, and that stretching action, you know, kind of in a lucid dream state, is what did it. It pulled me right out. It was very surprising the first time, less surprising afterward, but...
What were you stretching?
Kind of strange. Just reaching out. You know, he said to reach for something beyond your physical body, and that was what did it for me.
So
you
not
know,
it's a
simple little
stretching.
Thing. Yeah. Well, you know, yeah, when you're in a lucid dream, of course, you have a certain amount of control, and you can do things like, you know, I test a lucid dream usually by flying or jumping really high.
Mm-hmm.
Just to see, you know, if I can do it. And that stretching action was what did it for me. So, anyway, we're getting off the track.
Well, whatever that is. I mean,
yeah,
I'm
I
aware
know.
Of the pseudonym thing. And I'm also right. aware of wanting to talk about David Foster Wallace, because that's your essay, and that was sort of what prompted this conversation in many ways.
Okay.
And I think it is an interesting thing. And I'm... Some part of my brain, I'm looking for the way in which these things are all interconnected, and I know they are, because I can tell. I mean, I can just feel it. So, but
yeah.
What I got so far, referring to that part of my brain, is, well, astral projection, all that's like the double in Castaneda's thing, like developing the energy body. That's another identity, essentially, or another vehicle mm-hmm. for consciousness. Pseudonym, similar, you create a double. That's what I wanted to do with Aeolus Caphus. That was my sorcerer self. And by the time I met my wife, I was beginning Aeolus for real with Stormy Weather. I was actually embodying, giving a voice to that identity. And the way that my wife and I understood or talked about this was that Aeolus was like another, like a higher self or something. So sometimes she'd refer to me as Jake, sometimes she'd refer to me as Jason, and that was like my true self,
mm-hmm.
you know, my soul's essential self. Jake would be the persona or the ego, and then Aeolus was like the transcendental self or the god self or whatever we're gonna, you know.
Right.
Doesn't really matter now because I'm not really into that stuff, but point just being that there was definitely a period in my life where I did feel that it was like creating / connecting to
multiple selves.
Yeah, to another self and giving yeah. life to it.
Yeah, yeah, kind of like creating your own personalized tulpa.
Yeah,
there's I don't know if you saw this, but in that same issue of The New Yorker that the Fernando Pessoa essay was in, there was something in the letters section that jumped out at me. It was this professor of psychiatry from Trinity College in Dublin who was spouting off about Adam Gopnik's recent essay about American Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I'm going to quote it here because I've got it up on the screen, quote, contrary to what Gopnik writes, Buddhism does not teach that there is no self. Clearly, my self is typing this letter and your self is reading it. Rather, Buddhism says that selves are so changeable and dependent on external circumstances that the idea of a fixed self is an illusion. All is change.
Mm.
Unquote. So Yeah. I think that applies also. And, you know, I did start out kind of as a Buddhist in my 20s. And so that influence has always been there. Gnosticism seems more appealing to me these days, based on the state of the world. But, yeah.
I don't think Buddhism is very appealing. I mean, I don't think it's supposed to be, in a certain sense. And certainly the idea of not having a self isn't appealing. But even this idea, which I think is very true, that what self we have is constantly shifting and changing, so then it doesn't have any real continuity, which I think overlaps with the idea, which I was just talking about with my sister, that the self isn't a singularity, it's a multiplicity.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, I'd agree with
so
that.
we can narrate our experiences after we have them and turn them into a linear first-person narrative, which of course you and I as writers, that's what
we're,
you know,
constantly
we spend
doing.
Our days doing, and
yeah.
It gives us a great feeling of power and control. I'm sure, I know it does for me. But it doesn't mean that that's actually what we're experiencing as an organism.
Well, yeah, I mean, it would be impossible to describe, you know, what is actually happening to us. I mean, you know, things just spin too fast.
You think about all of our different cells, the multiplicity of cells, all, mm-hmm. Changing, exchanging information, and the bacteria and everything going on in the environment. Like, there's just an endless stream of changing data.
Yeah. David Foster Wallace wrote about that exact topic. I can't call it up right now. I don't know exactly where it is, but I remember him going on about that. I'd have to look it up, and maybe I can get it to you later.
Mm.
But, yeah, it was a beautiful passage about how there was just too much going on to ever capture it, although he did a much better job of capturing that flux than most people. You know, that interior monologue, or, you know, sets of monologues that we have. Unfortunately, most of the stuff he was writing about came from, you know, people that were either seriously addicted to drugs or, you know, clinically depressed. But,
I think that is, you know, I said recently, or I wrote, or both, that the mind's job, or my mind's job anyway, is to make us miserable 24/7. and not that's its real job, but it's somehow assumed this function in lieu of not doing what it really is supposed to do, which is a kind of just when it's needed, you know, you just call on the mind from time to time when you actually need it to crunch some data or analyze some experience or what have you, but most of the time it's not really needed, so you can just put it, sort of have it floating above one's awareness somewhere, you know, and just pull it down when you need it, kind of thing. And in lieu of that, it's like it's contrived for itself a function where it can be constantly working away, which is basically ruining everything.
You don't need to think about. Yeah, I agree.
You know, what do you feel about this? What does this say about you? So it had to create an I, a first-person subject self, to constantly refer to, so that it would always have something to narrate, right? As opposed to, as you say, you can't narrate everything that's happening in one's perceptual field the whole time, because one can't even perceive it the whole time, never mind, or all of it, never mind narrate it. So then it reduces it to just, no, it doesn't matter what's happening. All that matters is how it makes you look and how it makes you feel. That we can narrate. And I think that's what David Foster Wallace was, I think that's what he was obsessed with, and I think maybe that was partly why he was so, popular is not quite the word, but, you know, why he was elevated so, because I think he encapsulated as a writer the sort of relentlessly pernicious nature of that internal voice.
Yeah, in a particularly American way.
Yeah.
And,
because it centered around fame and success and being a somebody, right, which he got to experience.
And it did nothing good for him.
Exactly, yeah. A very young age, thinking that it was the thing he wanted most of all, and then discovering that it just actually made things worse for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the David Lipsky interview, he talks about how nothing was enough. You know, no amount of fame, no amount of accomplishment was going to be enough for him. And, you know, that was terrifying to him. Definitely not a very Zen attitude to take, you know, but I don't know. Obviously, I get deep into it in the essay. And I think where he really went wrong was, you know, his last book, The Pale King, his thesis seemed to be that you can achieve some sort of satori through excruciating boredom. You know, he was writing about, you know, tax collectors and what was going on in the IRS. And, you know, the subject itself seems incredibly boring, but that's where he went with it. And I think, you know, ultimately he was mistaken. I don't think that is a way to find any happiness in life, is, you know, to submit to excruciating boredom and think that that's going to lead to some sort of, you know, supreme moment of mindfulness.
What? Okay, so that was his chain of, that was his reasoning, was that if you submit yourself to boredom, as in if you strip away all the stimuli, your attention will then find its way to just being?
That's the sense I get. Again, I could quote passages if I had the book in front of me, but I don't.
While you're finding it, I'll just say it's very interesting timing, because I just listened to Paul Schrader talking about transcendental style in cinema, because he's revisiting that thing. He wrote a book about it when in his 20s. And that's similar to his take, that there's certain kinds of film that try to create an experience of the numinous or the spiritual through a kind of pulling away from the audience and a stripping away. And I mean, boredom is part of it. Yeah. It's not the whole of it, but
Chantal Ackerman was a director that did that, and oh my god, it was painful to sit through some of her movies. Yeah, and frankly, I don't remember feeling any sort of satori at the end of a Chantal Ackerman film, but, you know, maybe it worked for somebody else.
Well, I mean, and this is bringing to another point relating to Wallace and what we're talking about, that the thing Schrader said I listened to yesterday was, or this morning, was that the really pure filmmakers aiming for this transcendental style, they don't care about the audience at all.
Yeah,
they're trying to achieve it for themselves.
Well, yeah, maybe there's some hostility toward the audience, you know, underneath the surface or something.
Well, I mean, it's this the guy that I sent you in the New Yorker article. What was his name again?
Fernando Pessoa.
Yeah, what stood out for me there that I totally relate to was that it was something about how he was trying to. I'm not going to be able to find the words because it's such a bizarre concept, even though I'm always aware of it myself. Like, he was trying to stand out by not existing, in a sense. Like, he was trying to strip what he was doing to just nothing, really, and therefore be more remarkable for, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That sort of paradox, that contradiction.
Yeah.
That's the thing I'm always dancing around. Like, I want to somehow strip what I'm doing down so much that there's really nothing there, that it's really clear that I'm not doing anything, and therefore get noticed for that, right? To strip what I'm doing from the desire to be noticed, I guess is what I'm saying is the paradox, and be noticed for the person who is actually doing something so pure he doesn't care if he's being noticed or not.
Yeah, and you know, I think you and David Costanza really touched on that in that interview. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
I was just listening to that one the other day. And yeah, so what you guys were talking about was music and art as an expression of the soul that resonates with the spirit world.
Yeah.
And he said something to the effect that you receive a gift of inspiration and pass it on without worrying about how many people listen to your song or read your words. You know, and his attitude was to hell with the strange currency of Facebook likes and YouTube upvotes.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't matter to him. What mattered is if the world, you know, it didn't matter if the world took him seriously or not as an artist. You know, and I agree. I mean, you know, this is a world that takes Jeff Koons seriously as an artist.
Yeah.
there's something recently, there's an art critic in New York here called Jerry Saltz, who writes really sarcastic essays about the art world, and he overheard Koons telling somebody, "You don't get it, man, I'm a fucking genius." And he reported that. It went viral. It was great. So, you know, it's an upside down world, and the art world is especially indicative of that. And here's what I wanted to tell you. For me, one of the best moments in all of your podcasts was that moment when Costanza told you the story about how he was sitting at his kitchen table one day working on a song. And he started thinking to himself, what am I doing here, playing music for nobody? And then he said he had this really clear vision of a friend's daughter who had recently died, who came to him, and she said, "Who the fuck told you? You're playing for nobody." Mm-hmm. And it just gave him that connection to, you know, between the human world and the spirit world, and made him think that, you know, maybe that's worth doing it just for that sake.
Right, so that's the nothing that Fernando, whoever, is consciously or not, is referring to, I think.
Yeah.
So it isn't really about not being noticed, because if a tree falls in the forest and no one hears it, well, there's no sound. But so I wouldn't be trying to communicate if I. if I didn't want it to be received, because there wouldn't be a communication. But it's a question of where the transmission's actually going, and
when. I mean, with Pessoa, I think he didn't the article say that he had some insane number, 25,000 pages of manuscript or something hidden away in a trunk that was only found after he died. I may be getting that number wrong, but it was a huge number. I'd have to look at the article again. Just an enormous amount of writing.
Did you see that documentary about Salinger?
A long time ago. I don't remember it that well.
I mean, it was a few years ago, but it supposedly 2017 was the year of Salinger, because Salinger had written all these books in isolation and then died without telling anyone, and then they found them and they were going to release them. Do you remember that?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, because I'm wondering now if it was all a hoax, because these books haven't shown up.
Didn't he have a stipulation in his will that they couldn't be published until some year, because they dealt with people that were still alive?
I'm not sure if he did or not, but I know that the documentary said 2017 was when they were going to start publishing, so that's why I'm... Not that I'm a Salinger fan or anything, but anyway, in this context, like... Salinger is this kind of mythical writer. Some people say he's the most kind of whatever writer, like the key writer.
I don't know if I believe that.
That was in the New Pope, actually. I was trying to remember. There was a scene in the HBO series The New Pope where Jude Law's Pope is saying, who's the key filmmaker? The answer is Kubrick. Who's the key writer? The answer was Salinger, and so on. And he was picking people who withdrew from the public realm in some way.
And also had a strong connection to mind control programs.
Because you mentioned Abramovich and Jeff Koons, I think, as well.
Yeah. So, yeah, isn't that interesting how, you know, Catcher in the Rye was used in two assassinations? I don't know what to say about Salinger. I used to like his writing. I haven't read him for years. My suspicion, though, is that he is so overhyped that he was afraid if he released anything during his lifetime, you know, he would experience what Harper Lee experienced with her book after To Kill and the Mockingbird. She finally released the other book. I'm forgetting the name now. Wasn't it? What's? Do you remember?
No, I don't remember. I haven't read any of hers.
But anyway, I mean, that book kind of got trashed, you know, and I would suspect that would have happened to Salinger, too.
Hmm. So then, it's again damned if you do and damned if you don't. There's no win situation at a certain point, because what happened with Foster Wallace was that he got so raised up
Yeah,
that.
the same sense. Yeah, he could never surpass Infinite Jest, and I think he was kind of afraid to even try at a certain point.
But don't you
So.
think that that's a sort of superficial concern as compared to being turned into something that you know that you're not? Because that's, I mean, bringing it back to closer to the crux of what we're talking about, I think, here, this whole thing of creating a tulpa self that will then take over your real self. Well, of course, that's what my brother did or tried to do. I mean, I succeeded, let's say, as clearly as anyone did with the whole mythic narrative of the play coming out about his life, or based on his book, and him saying, "Oh, when you see your doppelganger, you die," and then him dying that very night. I mean, it doesn't get more archetypal than that.
Did he actually say that? I've
He
never heard that.
actually said it. It's online. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I know.
Wow.
So, I mean, this really is a profoundly recurring theme. In terms of, what is an artist or a writer aspiring to, even if they don't write about themselves? I mean, it was very obvious in my brother's case that he was creating a persona. He even more than admitted it. It was what he was doing. That was the whole thing. He said, "My personality is my greatest creation." So he, I guess it's revelation, the method, really. He was exposing the mechanics of what all of us are doing.
Yeah, just on a spectrum. Obviously, he's at one far end of it.
Yeah, and
Yeah,
which always
wow.
backfires, I would say.
Probably. Certainly, it didn't do any favors for David Foster Wallace.
I
put them under your microphone, your microscope, for various reasons, but this was definitely one of them. Like his relationship with depression. And I mean, what I got from Wallace was not so much from reading, because I just read a little bit. I could say some reader had read my piece on The Counselor, and for whatever reason he compared it to David Foster Wallace's breakthrough piece about the cruise, I think it was. But I think it was the essay about a supposedly fun thing or whatever, where he's writing about things that we're supposed to enjoy.
Yeah, I think it was the cruise ship article. Yeah, it was definitely a kind of journalism that we'd never seen before.
Right.
And David Lipsky described it as the sort of writing that mirrored the way my friends and I all talked and thought. Yeah. And, you know, nobody'd ever really seen it done that way before, you know, with all the footnotes and kind of the slangy jargon connected with, you know, obviously very great powers of observation and beautiful sentence structure. It was an amazing feat to pull off. And, you know, that it was kind of sui generis. I mean, you can refer back to Tom Wolfe and Hunter S. Thompson, but they didn't go take it as far as David Foster Wallace did. So, yeah, it was pretty amazing.
So, you know, what I was going to say was that just apart from those few things I read, most of what I got of Wallace, the impression I got was watching interviews on YouTube, child of the present culture. And what I got from that, I mean, one thing I noticed was that I liked him less the more time went on. Like the earlier interviews, he was much more likable than later on. And I thought, and what really stood out in relation to that was how self-referential he became.
Yeah.
Like how even when he was speaking, he was commenting on himself, commenting on the question that he was being asked. You know, he was David Foster Wallace doing an interview, talking about how it felt to be David Foster Wallace doing an interview, talking about how he felt. You know, it was like mirrors within mirrors. So that seems to be, I mean, that I think that was part of his skill set, whatever, that he had this ability to go meta and to be self-referential in the footnotes and all that, so it was many layered and very reflective and all of that. But I also suspect that it was the source of his misery in terms of being always kind of removed from his own experience.
Yeah, I got that too. You know, and he did address that at various points. He said he was conflicted. You know, of course, you have to be somewhat of an introvert to spend... Wow, that's loud. To spend the amount of time it takes to write a book like Infinite Jest, which is just a massive, massive undertaking. He wrote that book out in longhand twice before typing it into a computer for a third straight pass all the way through. And the initial first draft was 1,600 pages.
Mm-hmm.
So just an enormous book. And, you know, good for him. But, yeah, you have to be able to go deep inside yourself and not have a lot of outside stimulus to do something like that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he did say that he was a bit of a performer and he liked the attention that he was getting in some ways. Mostly he just wanted to get laid, though. And, you know, he was hoping that the book tour would help him accomplish that. But I guess it didn't pan out during the Infinite Jest tour. Maybe later it did. You know, with that kind of deep internal conflict, you would expect him to alternately be nervous and boastful, you know, in an interview situation. I found that Charlie Rose interview particularly painful to watch, the later one, when he was by himself.
Mm.
He did better when he was with Franzen and Mark Lehner. You know, it seemed lower key, and they seemed happier together than Wallace on his own, which, you know, maybe is just perfectly natural, but...
So yeah. Why do you think that he's been so deified, then, besides the fact he died young?
Well, that's the thing. We love our suicides in this culture for some perverse reason, don't we? You know, or, you know, people that die young. And, you know, he did that, and... You know, again, a lot of people have addressed it. His friend Jonathan Franzen addressed it in a New Yorker article that he caught a lot of shit for because he wasn't in the St. Wallace camp. He, you know, did say that Wallace was mentally ill, and, you know, that was the price Franzen had paid for, you know, really loving a mentally ill person. And I think, you know, Franzen probably... well, how do I put this delicately? Maybe just overstepped a little bit when he said that Wallace, you know, took his life in the... let me see if I can get the exact quote, because it's something I don't want to screw up. But the paragraph that stood out for me with the New York article that Franzen wrote was, he wrote, "He was sick, yes, and in a sense the story of my friendship with... David Foster Wallace, is simply that I loved a person who was mentally ill. The depressed person then killed himself in a way calculated to inflict maximum pain on those he loved most, and we who loved him were left feeling angry and betrayed. Betrayed not merely by the failure of our investment of love, but by the way in which his suicide took the person away from us and made him into a very public legend." So... You know, I mean, how should he have committed suicide if he needed to do it? I mean, there is no good way to do it, of course. You know, like Dorothy Parker said, you might as well live. But, you know, it's my problem with Franzen is, you know, it doesn't seem very friendly to go, you know, publicly in the New Yorker and say that, you know, your old friend did something, you know, in the cruelest way possible to everyone he loved. You know, it's debatable whether that's true or not. Obviously, he felt like he had to make an exit. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I've never read Franzen. I don't suppose I ever will. He doesn't seem like a writer that I would be interested in, and I didn't. That did seem pretty shallow, what he said there.
Yeah, but he is actually a very good writer, and you might be interested in his latest book. It's called Purity, and it's kind of a takedown of Julian Assange in a weird way. There's a very Assange-like character who is both a murderer and, in, you know, towards the end of the book, a suicide. So, yeah, obviously he's working through some issues there. But,
well, I don't know. I mean, well, I got a negative impression of Franzen, and probably based on Gary Height, who despises him. I'm very impressionable in that regard. Yeah. No, he doesn't know him personally. Okay. He's that kind of writing, or what he sees as that kind of writing.
Yeah.
But then, of course, we get to the general topic, which is also addressed in your piece, which is that anyone who's that embraced by the culture must be doing something wrong, but...
And that's the thing. I mean, the Assange takedown to me seemed incredibly wrong, but there it is. But I do like his books, actually. I have to admit that. I think he is a great writer in some ways. Over-rewarded, definitely. You know, singled out in a strange way that other writers never are.
Well, but I mean, that thing that you just quoted to me, that particularly as he's talking about somebody he knew, so you'd expect extra sensitivity and care with words. To dismiss anyone as mentally ill, as if, you know, as if that explains something. I mean, the very term mentally ill is very weak, I think. I'm always criticizing my wife for using it. It's not a term that is very well established, let's say, or maybe it's too well established, but I mean, it's not really backed up by very much, the whole concept of mental illness.
It's just a blanket term.
Yeah, and it conflates a physical thing with a psychological thing, and they don't. You can't superimpose physical illness onto the psyche, right? The two things don't actually. Anyway, but that, without getting into the pedantics of that, the notion that David Foster Wallace's suicide can be explained by the fact he was mentally ill. Well, I mean, that's just circular logic in itself, and it completely conveniently leaves aside the possibility that he was driven to suicide by things in his environment, which I would say is invariably the case. I don't think anyone's born with a suicide program.
No, probably not. Yeah, I think there's definitely some truth to that.
Seems like it, doesn't it? There's always going to be suicide's always going to be sourced in an unbearable tension within somebody, and bringing it back to this subject that we started with, which I keep wanting to come back to, that they haven't been able to find a social currency, find a way of being in the world that actually allows them to express and breathe from their core. They've had to distort and twist themselves in ways that are just unbearable.
Right. Well, I think the expectations were so high for him too. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, he kind of wrote himself into a corner, so to speak. I mean, you know, anything that he was going to publish, you know, from a certain point on was going to just, you know, have massive amounts of attention put on it, and he probably felt that he wasn't always up to it. I mean, I don't know about you, but I definitely have days where I just think I can't put anything good down on the page. I'm just not mentally at my peak or anywhere near it. And then there are other days where, yeah, I can sit down and, you know, I can bang out 10 pages and they're good pages and I can keep them. But, you know, it's part of writing for me is learning to recognize those times when it's just not flowing right, and, you know, I'm not at my best because I'm distracted by something or whatever. And maybe, you know, when he went off Nardil is when things really went south for him, and maybe he had that feeling that he just couldn't live up to, you know, the quote David Foster Wallace that everybody expected.
Well, I mean, because if he's identified with being a writer, I mean, I guess this is the trap we're talking about. So if we discover ways, strategies for coping that help us get through the day, in our case, in all the cases, you know, the people we're talking about here, it was writing, or one of them was writing, a main one was writing, then, of course, a lot is riding on that. As you say, if you can't write a certain day, that's kind of a bad day. I mean, this isn't actually my experience currently. We'll maybe get to that at some point, but I certainly can relate to it. But so then what happens if you get a disproportionate or even a proportionate amount of recognition for your writing, to the extent that
your sense of self-worth is wrapped up in it.
Exactly.
So extremely.
And you get further and further removed from the freedom of just writing for yourself, even knowing that you are going to share it, but still, it begins with yourself. You know, you're not... I mean, to this day, I'm not thinking about my blog readers when I write, except so far as, oh, they'll enjoy this, you know, once I've got something to give them. But in the process of writing, I'm just thinking about the material.
Yeah, no, I don't either. And, you know, frankly, I've only got about a half dozen loyal readers, so I don't really worry about
well,
it that
right,
much.
Exactly. So and you don't hear from them, and you don't do book tours and whatnot, and you don't have to do interviews on Oprah and all the rest of it. Essentially, you know, the primary relationship remains you and the process of writing, or you and the word.
Yeah, exactly. Taking the chaos from within and getting it down on the page in a narrative that you can share with other people. Yeah.
Yeah, and that to me, the process there is—it's really done once the piece is done. The sharing it is, whatever that is.
Secondary,
I mean, I'm going to think of a metaphor there, but nothing's coming to mind. But essentially, it's absolutely secondary. I mean, it's not dispensable because you know, it has to go out there, it has to be
well,
seen.
Right. It's part of the duty, like you and David Costanza were saying, you know, it's you get the inspiration and then you pass it along. You know, that's passing along that gift that was given to you. You know?
Yeah, and in Costanza's thing, I mean, his point about the spirit world, I would say one could sort of reformulate that without necessarily bringing spirits in, that there's an interior communication that's occurring through writing that allows for a transmission and a reception of the transmission, an echo, you know, and an integration and a giving thanks and whatever else that happens within my own psyche. Like I'm acknowledging some of those voices and some of those parts that haven't been acknowledged, recognizing them, integrating, becoming more whole through the process of doing it. That's actually happening before anyone sees it. So that could be the dead, or it could be my own inner fragments, or it could be both. I mean, it could be the same thing even.
I was thinking of your friend Paul Bowles, and you know, he definitely did seem to believe that there was a connection to that spirit world. And there's a famous quote of his. Do you know it? A writer should be a spy sent into life by the forces of death. His main objective is to get the information across the border back into death. Then he can be given a mythic personality. He spent time among us, betrayed us, and took the material across the border.
Part two of this conversation with Darren Westland should be up next Wednesday, the 27th of September 2017. That's at horticulture.com/liminalists. Thanks to Michael for donating this week.
Turns out we're evolving above. Thought I'd call, but I got nothing to say. Good luck.